The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Jeff Dill, and I'm the CEO of Vynamic. We're a healthcare industry management consulting firm based right here in Philadelphia. And we believe there's a better way to lead change in the healthcare industry. I'm proud to be at the Free Library tonight, as the library is also leading change in our community. By advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity for all Philadelphians. Its new Business Resource and Innovation Center, the BRIC, provides job seekers with resources on changing careers, local nonprofits access to Philadelphia's largest publicly accessible collection of fundraising and nonprofit management resources, and entrepreneurs with the support they need to grow their ideas into full-fledged businesses. This and other critical work is made possible only through the generous private support from people like you. Tonight, it's my great pleasure to introduce Howard Schultz, the former chairman and CEO of Starbucks, who led the Java giant from 11 cafes in the Seattle area to more than 28,000 locations worldwide, ranked fifth on Fortune's 2018 list of world's most admired companies. He's the author of several books, including Pour Your Heart Into It, How Starbucks Built a Company One Cup at a Time. He's also the former owner of the Seattle Supersonics, and with his wife Sherry, the founder of the Schultz Family Foundation, which supports national initiatives focused on employment and the needs of veterans. His new book, From the Ground Up, is part memoir and part manifesto of corporate social responsibility, interweaving his inspiring trajectory from a Brooklyn housing project to leading one of the world's most iconic companies. Tonight, Mr. Schultz will be in conversation with William Crystal, founder and former editor-at-large of the Weekly Standard. Please welcome Howard Schultz and Bill Crystal.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
I feel like after that handshake, we should have a debate or something, but we can have a presidential debate here in Philadelphia. Thank you all for coming, and I'm really honored to be able to toss some questions and have a conversation with Howard Schultz, who's a major figure, obviously, in American business, in American public and civic life, and I gather has some interest in some political endeavor this year, which you can explain it. You can talk about that.
Well, it's been an interesting few weeks. That.
Let me begin with this. I want to say a word about this book. I've read many memoirs of politicians, obviously, some of business leaders. This is really unusual and worth reading, I will say honestly. But one of the most striking things about it is how it begins, with an account of a somewhat unnerving, I would say honestly, account of a, as you call it, I think, a raucous and hard-edged poker game in your apartment, in your parents' apartment when you were a kid. And
yeah.
Say a little bit about that, and why did you begin with that? It's obviously was important to your...
Yeah. Well, Bill, thanks so much for being here. Yeah. I really appreciate it, and thank you all for coming. The book does open up in a unique fashion. We lived in a two-bedroom apartment in public housing, and my parents struggled most of their life with financial insecurity, and my father was a World War II veteran laborer, and just money was always a problem. When I was a young boy, my grandmother was literally a professional gambler. True. And she held card games at her home, and she selected all the players who would come. She was the bank. She had food. She charged interest. She had a chauffeur that had the whole deal. And it was all illegal. But one day I came home from school in my two-bedroom small apartment, and I noticed that my furniture was being rearranged. And my mother told me that we're going to have an early dinner tonight, and you and your sister need to stay in your room tonight. And for the next 3 to 4 years, the card game actually took place in my apartment. And what I witnessed and what I heard through the very thin walls was kind of the abuse going on between the players and my grandmother. And then my mother turned out to be the hostess, and my father turned out to be the chauffeur. Now, they did that to basically earn money, but my grandmother was a tough lady, and it scarred me and imprinted in me for in my formative years a very tough daily life, because every time I kind of turned the doorknob to my apartment, I didn't really know what to expect. And I spent many a night under the covers, not being able to go to sleep. And then I'd wake up in the morning, furniture was not put away, you could smell alcohol, cigarette smoke, and it was just really a not a good situation. And I opened the book with that to just demonstrate a couple of things. The vulnerability I still have, the insecurity, and kind of the shame that I experienced as a young boy in a lot of different episodes that involved how my parents struggled and the cause and the effect on me, my sister, and my brother.
And what do you think allowed you to move away from that and, do well? I mean,
well, the truth is, I wrote the book and revealed all this for the first time because I realized I've never escaped it. That these scars that I have and the shame that I experienced as a kid has been with me my whole life. Now, I remember I have a childhood friend, and we were having a beer one day about a year ago, and I was talking about the book and everything, and he said to me, you know, if it wasn't for your parents, you wouldn't have had the motivation you have. And so stop blaming them. So I'm not, I wasn't writing the book or blaming my parents, but I was describing the fact that this is what I experienced, and probably in most cases, if I came from a family of privilege, I would not have had the fear of failure, I wouldn't have had the drive to get out of public housing, and perhaps I wouldn't be here in this way. But in the same token, those scars and level of shame has never really left me. And perhaps I'm trying to prove something to my parents my whole life. Unfortunately, they've passed away a long time ago and didn't see much of my success.
You do talk about scars, but I also think it struck me reading the book how much, even though you were a hugely successful CEO and then chairman of a very successful and impressive company, how much you worried about things that you were doing and weren't doing, both at the company level and individually. You took on various social issues, whether it was, well, you should talk about them, but health insurance for your employees. I'm very struck by what you did for the military, and it strikes me that unlike a lot of businessmen, a lot of successful people, period, who are happy to be successful and don't maybe reflect that much about others who aren't quite as well situated, that was not the case with you, I think.
No, I think in so many different ways, I witnessed my father never having much of a purpose professionally, kind of being disrespected as a blue-collar worker, not finding the dignity of work. And so in many ways, everything I tried to do at Starbucks was to literally build the kind of company he never got a chance to work for. So we were the first company in America, literally 20 years before the Affordable Care Act, to provide comprehensive health insurance to every employee, including part-time people. Then we gave everyone ownership, and then 3 years ago did something that no company had done before, and that was free college tuition for every employee, including part-time people. And I think these kinds of programs I've put in place because we were always trying to build a different kind of company that would balance profit with responsibility. But in the back of my mind, I've always kind of seen the shadow of my father, who was a broken man and quite bitter, viewed himself as a victim, unfortunately. And also I write about some of the physical abuse that came with the rage that he had. And many times towards me.
Yeah, no, it's a rough, I mean, it was a rough childhood, and it's not an, it's a good read, I mean, it's an interesting read, but it's not an easy read. You know, you expect an upbeat book about, you know, American success story, and it's a different form of beginning, but honest. And
yeah, it is very honest and very revealing, and you know, very close friends of mine, who've been friends of mine for 30 years, didn't know any of this, read this book and said, I feel like I didn't know you. And I've hid all this because of shame.
How hard was it? I'm curious. So you're running Starbucks and you decide health insurance, not just for all full-time employees, which would be more, maybe a little more common, but for part-time employees as well. How hard was that to sell to your, you were a public company at this point, right?
Yeah.
And you had the board of directors, you had shareholders, you had colleagues. How to talk a little bit about how that happened.
Well, I think shareholders generally are interested primarily in one thing, and that is shareholder value and profit. And I took on the position a long time ago that shareholders need to be linked with our employees in terms of creating value. The story I write in the book, though, is in 2008, well after we had health care for every employee, during the cataclysmic financial crisis, companies were in very bad shape, and we were as well. And we got a call. I got a call from an institutional shareholder who basically threatened me and said, you need to cut your health care costs. Everyone's doing it. You have license to do it. But if you don't do it, we're going to sell our shares. And I think what I'd like to share with you is that, you know, Starbucks doesn't have a patent of any kind. And so anyone can open up a coffee store, and many people have. But the proprietariness of the company is the culture, the values, and the guiding principles. Our culture would be completely fractured in terms of the trust that our people would have in management if we would have taken healthcare away. So I refused that shareholder, and then, in effect, 3 months later, I noticed that about 60-70% of his holdings was gone. He made a terrible mistake because the stock is up 24,000%.
That's good.
But it does demonstrate something, and that is not every business decision should be an economic one, and I've learned that lesson 100 times over the years.
Yeah, I was very struck in the book by what your involvement with young 9/11 veterans and your effort. You said you had been sort of not, most people you knew hadn't, you know, didn't have kids who were serving necessarily, and but then you sort of were, we'll talk about that. It's a very interesting part of the book.
Well, we were blessed at Starbucks that Secretary Robert Gates retired to Seattle, Washington. And as a result of that, he joined the Starbucks board. And once he got on the board, he started sharing with me his deep, profound concern for a million plus extraordinary young men and women who had won the Cloth of the Nation were coming home with really tough transitional issues. And so my wife, Sherry, and I, who was here tonight in the front row, nice to see you. With the prodding of Secretary Gates and the understanding of what was going on, got deeply involved in these issues. And so Starbucks has hired about 20,000 veterans and or their spouses. We've opened about 50 stores very close to bases. And then our family foundation has done something quite unique in combination with the military and the Department of Defense in actually building transitional training centers on bases, and so that before people transition out, they can get the kind of education and resources that they'll need so that they actually can find a job when they get out as opposed to going on unemployment. And as you know, many post 9/11 veterans suffer a great deal of depression, high rate of suicide, and getting a job is one of the most important things to create the kind of foundational security they need when they get out.
And one of the things, we were talking about this before, a little bit backstage, I mean, our son did ROTC in college and served in the Marine Corps in Afghanistan, and his view was that officers mostly did okay. You know, the officers had college degrees. The country now, unlike maybe 40, 50 years ago when we were young, respects people who served in the military. There are a lot of programs around the country, here in Philly and Wall Street, to help make sure 9/11 vets get a good shot at officers with college education, get a good shot at jobs in finance or business or whatever. It's the enlisted guys, I think, who have a little bit of a tougher time. They come in at 18, they have high school, they're high school graduates, they're in the military 3, 6, 9 years, very intense, and then they're out.
Yeah.
And they often, our son at least thought, they didn't get great counseling always. They sort of settled for the first job they got, or they got depressed, or they had issues, obviously, from the military. But I think Starbucks in particular has reached out to those, not to the officers.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, isn't that, I mean, a high percentage of those 20,000 probably are not officers.
No, that's true.
Officers
and
college
grads. As I said to you off stage, one of the secondary real benefits of hiring veterans has been the fact that the culture of the company has really been elevated because people feel a great sense of pride working alongside a veteran. Also, because only 1% of the entire population in America has a direct relationship with anyone who has served, Most people have not had any direct connection with anyone who has worn the cloth of the nation. So there's been a lot of secondary benefits. I just want to share one thing, and we talked about this earlier. Sherry and I were in a focus group when we were kind of going through this, and we heard a young man who was transitioning out say something, and when we heard it, it was just it was shattering and heartbreaking. And he said, "I have more anxiety about going on a job interview than I would if I had to go back to Afghanistan." And when you hear something like that, you almost say, "How could that be?" And it's because their life experience has not been anything close to corporate America, and they just have no understanding how their resume or their life experience, and certainly their military experience, applies to getting a job. And what we found is that integrity, ethics, leadership skills, understanding what it means to work on a team, these are extraordinary people, and their resources and assets to our country are well beyond their time in the service.
And I'm curious, I mean, have you studied this? I'm sure you have. Have they done well, the young vets?
They've done very well. And we've got so many success stories of how these people have been promoted and have great responsibility at Starbucks. One of the things we've learned is that we needed somebody within the HR department who was from the military, who could relate to them, relate to their language, help them with their understanding of what they've done in the military, and help them understand how to connect that to the right job. And without that, there was kind of not the right level of connection.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And also, I think there was a false narrative that these are damaged people. And that is it's tragic when we heard that. And we've done a lot of things to tell the Starbucks story about the relationship we've had with military with hundreds of other companies, so they understand the benefits, which are many.
Oh, that's great. And do you think corporate America in general has sort of stepped up on this?
They've done a pretty good job.
Yeah, that's my sense too, yeah. Speaking of that, we're here in Philadelphia. That was one of the, you tell the story of what happened at the Starbucks store here and what happened around it.
Yeah.
Very eloquently in the book, really. And I mean, let's talk about it since we're here.
Yeah. Well, I think you asked me if we can or should talk about this, and I think we should. I think racial injustice is a topic of conversation that we should not hide behind. So, like many of you here probably know the story, but I'll repeat it and then we can talk about what happened. Two young African-American men walked into a Starbucks store. They asked to use the bathroom. We had a bad policy in which it was really the manager's discretion. She was white. And she said, you can't use the bathroom unless you buy something. And they said, well, no, we're here to meet somebody, and we'll buy something later. And just in a matter of minutes, a verbal problem occurred. And she decided that she felt the threat. And she called 911. And within 10 minutes, six police officers showed up and immediately handcuffed these two young men and arrested them. Now, thank God they did not resist. And all of a sudden, we had a real serious problem. It was videotaped, it was taped on someone's phone, and it was put on the web, and 10, 15 million people saw it within a couple of hours. And Starbucks was completely at fault. Now, there was a tremendous level of immediate rush to judgment that the blame should be on the manager. And it was not the manager's fault. It was the fault of the company. And the fault was we had a policy that was not clear. And unfortunately, that policy led to a bad decision. We came to Philadelphia within 24 hours. We met with the two young men. We met with the head of police. We met with the DA. We met with clergy. And we tried everything possible to both apologize for a reprehensible act, but also, what can we learn from this? And that's the real question. And I would say, I believe that almost everyone here, if not all of us, have some level of unconscious bias based on our own life experience. And we felt strongly that we needed to take a step back from this incident and understand what we needed to do. So we solicited the help and advice of experts in the field on diversity and racial injustice in America, and as a result of that, developed a curriculum. And then we decided that we would close every store for an entire afternoon after the curriculum was done and train 180,000 people on bias training and racial issues of how to deal with people who are different than you and understand that we all come to this issue sometimes not wanting to discuss it and with a prejudgment about someone else who might be different than us. This curriculum has endured with every new hire and ongoing on a quarterly basis at Starbucks. And I said something last night on national TV that I think was misinterpreted, or but I'll try to explain it. You know, I grew up, as I said earlier, in public housing and in a very diverse area where there were about 80, 90 families in one building and a single elevator. And as a young boy, I didn't see color. My parents were not people who in any way were prejudiced. And that's how I grew up. And I said something like that last night and it was misinterpreted. I think we are living at a time right now where there's been a lot of incitement in many ways by the President of the United States. And I think the President of the United States holds a deep level of responsibility for the morality and the character and the integrity and the dignity of how we deal with each other, especially with regard to the values of humanity. And we have a lot of work to do, and I think it doesn't help that we have one incident, one episode after another, where we see a demonstration of a lack of respect for people who are not our same skin color or religion. And what I would say is this, is that regardless of your station in life, the color of your skin, your ethnic background, your sexual orientation, that everyone in America needs to be respected and valued, and everyone needs to have the same opportunity. And I think we have a long way to go. I didn't expect that you would stand up, but you were there and I wasn't, so I have great respect for what you saw and what you filmed. I think it's very important to say something to you with regard to how I responded on national TV a few days later with Gayle King. And I think this is a very important point because this is a very important subject that I do take very personally. And even before the Philadelphia incident, I was very active in trying to raise the national conversation about race, and unfortunately it didn't go well when we tried to elevate the national conversation about race together. You might remember that. And I wasn't planning on running for president when I did that. But the point I want to make is I was advised before a nationally televised interview with Gayle King not to say something that I knew was not true. And what was true is I spent time with the manager one-on-one, and I just asked her a simple question. And I asked her, if those two young men were white, would she have called the police? And to her credit, she said, probably not. And so once I heard that, I knew that what occurred was a form of racial profiling. And I was advised that you can't possibly say that on national TV because that's going to damage the company, the equity, the brand. You shouldn't do that. But once I knew what she said, I felt I had a moral obligation to say the truth. So when Gayle King asked me on national TV, do you think this was racial profiling? I said it was. And so I may not have been there, but I can tell you on a personal level, on a very emotional level, I was deeply, deeply concerned about what happened, and we've done everything possible to try and learn from it and get better. But this is not a isolated situation of Starbucks, as you know. This is a situation that the country is dealing with, and we have to get better at it. And I agree with you. We need to have conversations that might be uncomfortable. Let's stop there, okay?
Yeah, that's enough. Thank you. Thank you, though, for raising it. Well, are we doing? I mean, how are we doing as a country? Let's segue a little bit to the presidency. You have some interest in, and have some views about the current occupant of the office. So, where to begin, right?
Well,
let me ask you this first. This is unusual. I hadn't really thought of this. You've known presidents, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you were a major corporate leader.
Yeah.
I'm curious, before we get to Donald Trump, which is on everyone's mind, and you've talked about an awful lot over the last 2 weeks, what do you think of his predecessors? I mean, I'm curious. You've met them in a way that 99% haven't. I mean...
Yeah, I had great respect for President Obama. I actually did not know President Bush while he was president. I've gotten to know him after he's left office and established a very unique friendship and relationship with him and have a lot of respect for him. I knew President Clinton well. I knew Hillary. I think we've had good presidents. We've had bad presidents. And now we have the worst president.
That sums it up. That's good.
My own situation is the following. Let's see. I asked a question on national TV last night, and I've asked a question a couple of times at different town hall meetings, and I'll just ask it of all of you. How many people in this room believe that the United States government and our representatives are doing well for you, your family, and the American people? Raise your hand. Okay, so we have about 10 people out of, I don't know, 400 to 500. And it's been pretty consistent. On national TV last night, not one person raised their hand. But the segue to the question is this. We're living at an unprecedented time in terms of how fragile things are with regard to the leadership void within Washington. And I've come to the conclusion, just take President Trump aside for a moment, that we are witnessing a level of polarization and dysfunction among the extreme left and the extreme right that is unwilling to recognize what the people of the United States want. So if let's just take the issue of immigration, which is front and center right now, and whether or not the government is going to shut down or not. Maybe there's been some news tonight, I don't know. But as we sit today, the latest poll says 78%, which is a vast majority of the American people, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, red states, blue states, they want, desire, and they are longing for a comprehensive, sensible immigration reform bill. And basically what they want is something that is sensible. Now, the far right wants to build a wall of some kind, wants to do everything they can to limit immigration. They have stripped mothers from babies. They have put children in places that they can't find their parents. The Democrats want to abolish ICE, and the Democrats want to do something which I agree with, which is provide citizenship to the Dreamers and allow the 11 to 12 million immigrants, unauthorized people who are here, a pathway to some level of citizenship. Now, if 77, 78, 80% of the American people want something done, the question is, why are members of Congress unwilling to reach a compromise and collaborate with each other? And the reason is because every single day, they are involved in revenge politics on one subject or the other. The irony of this whole issue is that both President Obama and President Bush handed Congress an immigration bill. And in both cases, Republican president, Democratic president, the oppositional party refused to allow that bill to pass because they would not give the other party and the president a political win. And so I'm asking a very simple question. And the question is, I think the American people deserve much better. I think the American people deserve to be in power of the government. I think the American people deserve to understand what's really going on with regard to gerrymandering and the unusual way in which we are selecting our representatives. And most importantly, I believe that there is a void of leadership and truth, and the government is not working. Today, as an example, for the first time in the history of the country, we reached a level of indebtedness of $22 trillion. $22 trillion, that is larger than the US economy. I have been a vocal opponent, as you have, to this issue and so concerned about it, because it's just a reckless example of both parties being complicit with regard to fiscal responsibility, spending much more money than we are taking in. And what that means for all of us, basically, is an immoral issue. And the immoral issue is, for the first time in generations, we are leaving the next generation with not an inheritance, but a stack of bills. And our children and our grandchildren are not going to have the benefits of the United States of America being able to invest in innovation, resources, solving the problems we have until we get our indebtedness in order. And these are the kind of things that I'm saying, you take this issue, the healthcare crisis, the education crisis, immigration, our standing in the world, a ridiculous trade war in China, all of these things are laddering up to the point where I think someone's got to stand up and say, listen, it's time for accountability, it's time for leadership, it's time for a level of trust and confidence, and I don't see a way to proceed myself, because I no longer recognize the party that I've been a part of, because they have gone so far the other way, and the Republican Party is so far to the right, that I think there's a compelling opportunity, because I think the silent majority of Americans are looking for and longing for someone who's not in bed with special interest, not based on self-preservation and ideology, but mostly doing everything they can to improve the lives of American families. That is what I've said. So over the last couple of weeks on 60 Minutes, I said I'm seriously considering running for president, and if I do, as a centrist independent, and that created a groundswell of,
How would you describe that groundswell? All right. Feel free to use colorful language. No one's watching, so it's okay.
Yeah. Well,
Just between us, off the record, what would you say? Right?
Off the record? I think it demonstrates that I've raised my voice and people are deeply concerned. I will tell this audience, as I've said to every other audience in the last few weeks, nobody wants to see Donald Trump fired more than me. I will do nothing over the next year to reelect Donald Trump, but I do feel strongly that it is an expression of our democracy that I do have the right to stand up and consider this. And this whole issue of me being a spoiler, as I said last night, I don't know how do you spoil a broken system that is already corrupt and not serving the American people. But I will do nothing to reelect Donald Trump, I can promise you that.
You've had businesses all over the world, and you're interested in, obviously, international politics, foreign policy. I mean, what worries you the most? I'm just curious. You know, we have a lot of problems out there, but what do you regard as really urgent and dangerous?
Over the course of the last year, I've had the benefit of being briefed by domain experts in a wide range of subjects and fields. And one of the things that I've been briefed on that really I wasn't really up to speed on, that really concerns me, is cyber warfare and cyber attacks on the United States of America. Now, right now, cybersecurity sits within the confines of Homeland Security. I don't know if that's the right decision or wrong. I'll leave that for the next president of the United States to decide. But I think there is serious concerns, and we all need to understand that every single day there are very, very bad actors from Russia, from Iran, from North Korea, and in China that are trying to do things. But the Russians specifically are trying to do everything they possibly can to disrupt our way of life and our democracy. And that is a very, very serious issue and a very serious concern. And this president has really, I think, turned a blind eye, in my view, on Russian interference. And I'm not talking about the investigation, just his decisions that he's made. As an example, I could not believe when I woke up one day and saw that he had unilaterally decided that we were going to pull out of Syria. And now, why is that a big problem? A number of reasons. One is that there is a complete lie and false narrative that he said that we have defeated ISIS. Not true. Second, that if we pull out of Syria, which has been a proxy war between the Saudis and the Iranians, we immediately give Russia and Iran an opportunity to have a stranglehold on that region. And that's exactly what's going to happen. Now, Russia will now become the leader in that region, which threatens our allies, specifically Jordan and Israel. And not only did he not have the humility to listen to his advisors, both the intelligence community and the military, but he did not even notify our allies that he was doing this. We should never pull out of Syria and give ISIS an opportunity to strengthen themselves. We need to fight them there to prevent them from coming here. That was a terrible mistake, among many strategic international mistakes he's made, including the current trade and tariff war with China, which is resulting in a consumer tax on every American consumer. And if you're a farmer or anyone in agriculture, if you're in the steel industry, you're seeing these markets go away. They won't come back for years. China is not an enemy of the United States. They are a fierce competitor. They are going to try and do everything to displace us as the number one economic power in the world. And if we're not careful and smart and very thoughtful and strategic, that is exactly what's going to happen. We've been doing business in China for 20 years. I probably have been to China more than any other CEO in the last decade or so. I've got great respect for them, but we also have to understand they are a fierce competitor. They see the world differently. And the way to deal with China and for us to succeed and maintain our position as the economic leader in the world is not through a ridiculous, unthoughtful way of getting into a trade and tariff war with them that has no end, and from what I can see, no strategic understanding of really what it is we're trying to accomplish.
On the other hand, people would say, and I would myself, I think, say this, that I'm a free trader, and I think the trade war is idiotic, but there are real intellectual property questions with China. I don't know
yes,
if you all dealt with them, but and
yeah, I think there are serious issues with China. There's no doubt about that. But this is the wrong approach.
And how worried are you, speaking of China, where there seems to have been a consolidation of power under Xi in the last 2-3 years, and obviously what's happening in Russia and elsewhere, one really worries, I do, that the whole democratic model is yielding ground to a kind of authoritarian model, which can sometimes produce, at least in the short term, economic growth, too, so they can say we're doing okay. But the degree of social control in China, and I mean, I haven't been there much at all, not nearly like as you have, but I mean, it's a worrisome future, it seems to me, a world of sort of in which Putin does well and Xi does well and, you know, dictators generally do well.
Yeah, but I think what you're suggesting, though, is true, but it also, I think, elevates the question of the need and the requirement of what is in the national interest of the United States. And I believe what is in our national interest is for us to cooperate with our allies, to be a leader throughout the world, both in terms of American values, American influence. And right now, under this president, you know, he's isolated ourselves from most every ally we've ever had, not to mention what he's done in terms of the EU, embarrassing NATO, getting into a fight with Canada and Mexico over what? I mean, I don't even understand it. But this is not a time for America not only to build a wall on our southern border, but to build walls with all of the countries that have been our friends and our neighbors for years. This is a time for America to build bridges and for the country to stand tall and to express and elevate American values throughout the world. And I think what you're speaking to in terms of authoritarianism and way in which governments are following the lead of President Trump, there's a lot to be learned here, is that we set the agenda in so many ways for many other countries and other leaders. And I do not want to see President Trump be the brand ambassador for the United States of America and our government.
Yeah, and the president is. Let me ask you one last question, then, I'll go to the questions you all have submitted and try to run through those quickly. And you can. I saw General Stanley McChrystal this morning in Northern Virginia, where I just randomly previously scheduled to see him. Very impressive man, obviously, who's very interested in national service, something I know you thought a lot about.
Yes.
You mentioned it in the book. What about some form of voluntary encouraging or incentives for something like voluntary national service?
Yeah.
Does it make sense? Would it be good for the country? Do you find people are interested in that?
I think, first off, General McChrystal, as you said, is an extraordinary man and has served this nation so honorably over many, many years. He has spent a lot of time kind of thinking through how could we create national service. I think that would be a fantastic program for the country. If you think back to President Kennedy and Sergeant Shriver with the Peace Corps, this is would be a wonderful opportunity to elevate national service in the country. I think if we think about national service today, as we said earlier, unfortunately, only the people who are volunteering and doing any kind of service are kids from privilege, because those are the only families that can afford it. But if we could fund and maybe create a private-public partnership in which businesses, philanthropies, and the government came together to create national service, I think it'd be a huge win for young people, and I think it would elevate the values and the nationalism of the country.
Yeah.
So it'd be great.
But
we'll see.
You have to figure out how to do it, I suppose.
Someone's got to lead it.
Yeah. No, I think it would be
maybe in 2 years.
Okay, good. Something happening in 2 years? I don't know. Let me go to some of your questions. A lot of them are, I think, predictably on the sort of more political side of things. And there are, surprisingly, here in Philadelphia, a few Democrats in the room, apparently. And I lived in Philadelphia and taught at Penn as a Republican. And it was,
you did? How'd it go?
It's very lonely. Very, it's many years ago. I haven't really been recovered from the scars yet, you know.
Well, you can talk about your own shame.
Yeah, no, I know. Thank you. Yeah, right. And now the Republican Party. Maybe I should have been all along, but on the other side. But I hate to even. Yeah. Anyway, it's not about me.
I didn't know you were so funny. Actually.
Yeah. Right. Well, what about the obvious question? You've been a Democrat, I think, most of your adult life. Donated to the Democratic Party. Helped out Democratic candidates and governors and presidents. I mean, it's one of the two major parties. It's important. It would be good if that party stayed, I think, I would say, as a Republican, as a responsible alternative governing party. I feel very much the same way about the Republican Party, which is why I'm trying to save that from Donald Trump, but that's a different endeavor. Assuming you're not going to come over and win the Republican nomination against Trump.
I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I'd be open. I could help you with that. I also have a bridge to sell you, if you'd like. But what about the Democratic Party? I mean, shouldn't you go and, you know, make your case to your fellow Democrats?
Yeah. Listen, I have nothing against the Democratic Party. I have a lot of friends who are both Democrats, and I have friends who hold office who are Democrats. This is not personal against the party or them. If I should decide to run for president, in many ways, I'm running against a two-party broken system. With regard to the Democratic Party, I no longer feel as if I have a home there. I feel that the party is moving so far left, and almost every day, further left. And so if we use the Green New Deal as a proxy, these are well-intentioned people who are trying to do good things. But you've got to think about things that are realistic, that are true, and that could happen. And so, as I said, we're $22 trillion in debt. Medicare for all would cost about $30 trillion, and most Americans don't realize that if that were to occur, you would lose your choice of doctor and your choice of your insurance provider, not to mention the disruption in the entire system. But what really got me in reading that document, which I talked about on national TV last night, was there was an element of the proposal that said that by 2030, every single building in America was going to have clean energy, every building. And I looked at that, and I was wondering, what? Is that possible? And so I asked somebody, how many buildings are there in America? And we did the math, and that would mean that close to 3,000 buildings a day would have to be transformed for clean energy. It also means that the government would have to take over those buildings and mandate to private citizens who own the building, whether it's an individual landlord or a corporation. And the government should not be doing that. That's not the government's responsibility. So if you look at what they're suggesting, again, well-intentioned, it's about $40 trillion on top of the $22 trillion debt that we have now. And Donald Trump is adding $1 trillion a year to the national debt. It's just not realistic. And so I am trying to suggest a more centrist approach to trying to solve these problems. And I don't think the Democratic Party is interested in listening to a centrist position. And I think if I had to make a prediction, the Democratic person who is going to get the nomination is going to be a far left-leaning person who's going to run against Donald Trump. And I'm not clairvoyant, but I worry a lot about whether or not a far left person on the Democratic side can defeat Donald Trump.
There's some actually very interesting questions here, which I'll get to in a minute, sort of offbeat. Though in the spirit of being in Philadelphia, I feel that I should begin with a very much more characteristically Philadelphia question, you know, given the way Philadelphia fans are. I love this first half sentence. Given the generally negative response to your announced candidacy, comma, that's very Philadelphia, I would say, you know? And then the question goes on, how will you proceed? I mean, how have the 2 weeks surprised you, affected you? What's your reaction?
Okay, so let me try and give you my theory of the case and why I've come to this early, not decision, but thought process. I'm going to give it to you in a number of ways. First off, 42% of the American electorate, registered voters, 30% are registered independents, and 12% say, I would affiliate myself as an independent if I had a legitimate choice. That's 42% of the entire country. That's more than either party. Now, people say that may be true, but when people get into the voting booth, they're not going to vote as an independent. We don't know that. I can tell you that if I were to run for president, we would be on the ballot of every single state. And the reason that's so important, not only because the DNC and the RNC does everything humanly possible to prevent it, but here's the real theory of the case. If you look back on the last 30 plus years, each presidential election has been decided approximately by 8 to 10 battleground states. Certainly that was the case with President Trump defeating Hillary Clinton. 8 to 10 states. That means if you're a Democrat in a red state, your vote and your voice does not matter because it's predetermined, and vice versa. And what I'm saying is that in a 50-state race with three people in it, where the American people realize for the first time in over 30 years that your vote and your voice really counts, because if you pull the lever for somebody who could win, you could disrupt the fact that your state no longer stays red or blue. And so I'm going to spend the next 3 to 4 months traveling the country, speaking to the American people, listening and learning, and after that period decide whether or not the math and what I believe is compelling, because we've been polling now for about 5 or 6 months, and the polls get compellingly better, especially after the unfortunate government shutdown where 800,000 people were without a paycheck for over a month. I think the American people are exhausted. I think they've lost trust and confidence in the government, in both parties. And I think both parties have an approval rating now at the lowest level, certainly in my generation. And I think the American people are longing for something else. And I'm going to try and suggest to them that I think there's a better way, that we can disrupt the system, we can reform it. And I think the American people are interested in what I have to say. If they're not, as I said earlier, I will not proceed, and I'll go back to my life. but I'm here for one reason. And I really want to say this from my heart. 40% of the American families today are within $400 of a real crisis of personal insolvency or bankruptcy. Almost 5 million young kids in America are not in school, not in work. One out of seven people in America don't have food at night. We have a homeless crisis in America. We have a mental health crisis in America. We have an opioid crisis in America. We have an education system that's not working from K through 12. We have an indebtedness of over $1 trillion of students who have not completed college, had to leave school because they couldn't afford it. We have serious problems that require a level of leadership, accountability, and we have a history now of one episode and one example after the other in which the extremes of both parties are in bed with special interest, are more concerned about self-interest, re-election, self-preservation, and ideology than solving these problems. And I want to try and solve them. That's why I'm here.
I feel that the next question that I actually have here on the card, I have three or four I'm going to try to get in here, which I thought were quite interesting, is a little bit of a downer after that genuinely strong statement, but I feel like it's an important question anyway. If Joe Biden asked you today to be his VP, would you say yes? This is a true question.
Yeah.
It's written by one of Joe Biden's relatives from Scranton who came down to Philly, I guess. I don't know.
I know Vice President Biden well. In fact, his niece works at Starbucks.
Yeah.
But the answer would be no. I have great respect for the vice president, but I'm not interested in that kind of opportunity. So, no.
This is, what single event, I think the questioner probably means public event, but take it either way, private or public. What single event has inspired you most in your life?
It has to do with my mother, and I write about this in the book. My mother had a deep, deep belief in the country and the fact that our station in life was not going to define us, and she imprinted and pulled and pushed me to believe that I could graduate from college, first person in our family. But something happened as a young boy. It's a great story that I tell in the book. So every Wednesday afternoon, we did not have a public library where I grew up in the Canarsie section of Brooklyn. We had a bookmobile. Has anyone ever seen a bookmobile?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. I've asked this question in other groups, and people don't know what I'm talking about. So,
Philadelphia, you know, they got right.
So every Wednesday afternoon, my mother took me by the hand, and we went to the bookmobile, got a book, went home, read the book, and that was the cycle. Well, one afternoon, she picks me up from school, and I think we're going to the bookmobile. I'll get to the inspiring story, but here it is. So there's no bookmobile. We get on a bus. I can't never remember being on a bus with my mother. And I'm 7 years old, and the bus is about a 20-minute ride. We get off the bus, and we walk, it seems like, a few miles. And we get to a massive, massive crowd of people. She's holding me by the hand. I can't see over anyone's head because I'm a young kid. And I hear the voice of a young senator from Massachusetts campaigning in Brooklyn, New York, running for president. It was John F. Kennedy. My mother had this unbelievable relationship with President Kennedy, as if he was speaking to her. Her hand gripped me so tight, and I looked up at her, and she was glowing as if he was talking to her. And that one event, not that it was the most inspiring event in my life, but one of the most memorable. A, I heard the voice of President Kennedy, and I saw my mother, probably the happiest she ever was, within the distance of him. Now, unfortunately, 3 years later, I saw the opposite, and that was how she was devastated, crushed, on November 22nd, 1963, when he was assassinated.
Yeah, you speak movingly of that in the book. I mean, it was obviously a really... I was old enough to remember it. It was shocking and terrible, but she seems to have really taken it in a whole different...
My mother was never the same person. I think she suffered from depression her whole life, but for three, 4 days, She did not leave the couch. She was stuck in front of the black and white television, smoking cigarettes, crying, sobbing, and it just devastated her. It fractured her life. And I think she lost a sense of belief in the country after we lost President Kennedy.
Here's a question. What is your plan to create a living wage in this country? Something you all did some work on at Starbucks.
Well, the issue of living wage, I think, also speaks to the minimum wage, so maybe we should start there. The question I think I've been asked a lot lately is, should the minimum wage nationally be $15 an hour? Not that that is a living wage, but let's start there. We have evidence of this now in the state of Washington where it's been mandated that it's $15 an hour. And we're seeing a few things that are troubling, and that is people are losing their jobs because of scheduling issues, and people are using less labor as opposed to more. And so the jury is out as to whether $15 an hour should be a federal mandate or not. So I think at this point, for me, I want to wait and see and study this. So right now, I think that should be a state issue. With regard to, we need comprehensive tax reform, and we need it now. So I was a vocal critic from the minute President Trump announced that he was going to give every corporation in America a tax cut from 35 to 21%. That was a terrible mistake, even though Starbucks benefited from it, but we gave almost 60% of it back to our people, did not keep it for ourselves. But there was a massive opportunity for comprehensive tax reform, of raising the income tax on people like me. I should be paying more taxes. Corporations at a 21% should never have been given that. Should have been 25, 26 with an incentive to invest back in your people, training, education, into the community, and there should be lower taxes for the middle class. I would start there. But the tax code today is about 80,000 pages. It's insanity. And it's insane because, again, of the special interest and the complicitness of both parties unwilling to do what's necessary on behalf of the entire country. But if I ran for president and I was fortunate enough to win, I can assure you that I would immediately address the need for comprehensive tax reform.
This is another classic Philadelphia question. Does it feel uncomfortable for you to speak to an audience that isn't overly supportive of you?
Come on.
I'm not
really?
Making this up.
Come on. You know,
you seem to handling it okay.
I'm a Jewish kid from Brooklyn that has lived the American dream. And if someone told me when I was 15 years old that I would reach this level of success, I would not have believed it, nor would I have bet on it. But it can only happen in America. And we should celebrate that.
I feel that I just got the signal that we should wrap up. It's past 8:30, so perhaps on that note,
okay.
We should have a final...
I thank you all very much for coming. I've been to Philadelphia a lot over the last couple of years. It's a great community, and I'm happy to be here. I thank you very much for listening, and I can tell you one thing. Over the next few months, what I'm only trying to do is do everything I can to enhance the lives of the American people, especially those families that are being left behind. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.